Can you guys hear me?
Which one is it? This one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's okay. Oh, okay. Sorry about the delay. Can blame Dell for that. So thank you for the introduction, and also to Afzal and other hosts of this workshop. This is my first time at NIST. So I'm going to talk about 3D and 2D shape for biometrics and other practical applications. So first of all, 20 plus years working in this area, come to realize working with a lot of folks in other disciplines. I just want to throw it out. You know, features like beauty, you talk to even within the same domain, the experts disagree on what the features are. So that was quite apparent yesterday, some of the manufacturing talks that people in casting and welding can't agree on what features are. So I just wanted to throw it out there. Also, I don't know how many people remember Romulus solid modeler system. I worked on it 20 years ago, and I thought that over this period of time, at least the CAD problems would be solved. But listening to some of the talks yesterday, it's apparent there is still some more work to do, and maybe I'll get back to it one of these days. I pulled up this paper. I don't even have this paper anymore, and I was the first author on that. Anyway, I'll talk about the applications first, more so to motivate. Now, a lot of the motivation for the talks have been more from the CAD and manufacturing, and then some of the stuff in the protein and bio data structures. But here's a scan of my colleague. He's an artist, sculptor, and he, as his data was being scanned on full body scanner, he stood on a lazy Susan and spun himself around. That's art, right? But as computer scientists, you got to deal with that kind of data and that kind of surface, and you can just see the mess here. Some of the things that CAD people in CAD don't, maybe people who are in RP business and deal with bad triangulation and triangle meshes that deal with it, but this is really crappy. This is a project we did. For Native American, working with archaeologists on Native American pottery from 11th century to characterize, since these were handmade, the potter's wheel was not discovered in America by Native Indians. So we're looking at curvature map and to see how good a potter from that time was. This is looking at brain implant stuff in a mouse. So this is confocal laser microscopy, so data several magnitudes smaller than this one. Again, cell while it's dividing. Face biometric data, I'll talk a little bit more about it. This is a laser scan of a bone with curvature mapped on it. It's the pubic symphysis that goes between the two legs and is often used for age and sex determination when you find grave sites or where other evidence is not available. And then lately we've been messing around with something to do with handwriting, and I'll mention a couple of things there too. So we just finished our famous project on reconstructing George Washington at 1945 and 57, and if you go to Mount Vernon, the three life-size Georges were built in my lab, or working with a forensic anthropologist, we recreated his faces from a 53-year-old bust. Just as a reference point there. So there is a lot of different ways to not only do the search, but analysis that is critical for 3D data. I wanted to show you that, but since I had to change my laptops, I have a plugin that can display 3D data in PowerPoints. In general, if somebody's interested, you can talk to me. Turns out it's my software company. But another type of work we've done is look at determining surface roughness characteristics, not from manufacturing point of view, but working with a geophysicist. They're interested in different kind of fluting that happens on rocks. And then these are man-made rocks that are run in the wind tunnel with sand to mimic the environment on Mars. And our hope is that we get lucky one of these days for one of those proposals to NASA where we can put a sub-10 micron laser scanner on a rover arm. And by looking at the fluting pattern, this is in Mojave Desert, the idea is, can you come up with some idea as to what phenomena caused it, whether it was, you know, sand, wind, and it's one of the harshest conditions at least in the United States, in the Mojave Desert. So that's another. As I said earlier, we've been looking at some of the bone joint surfaces. This is trapezium. This is the bone that sits at the base of your thumb and is responsible for differentiating us from our cousins or whatever you want to call it, the chimps. And because you can do a baseball grip or a cricket ball grip, if you will. I see some Indians here. And if you hold the key in your car ignition and you can twist it, and that all stems from the differentiation that happened in the bone structure in the hand. So I've been working with physical anthropologists and helping them analyze curvature and other shape characteristics of the articulating joints for them to understand where this evolution happened. And more importantly, some of the fossils were misclassified in different ages, and then there is some argument now that, for example, the anthropology student who was working on this is at Museum of Natural History as a postdoc now, and I had dinner with him last night, and his findings just came out in an article in Science, and he's working on the new Hobbit stuff, which was discovered, and is applying the same tools that we developed together to characterize where the hobbits' hand bones, at least, don't look like human. So it has that intermediate characteristic. So that's very interesting to take your science and tools outside your domain and work with these people. And, you know, they come up with these fascinating discoveries. So one of the things that they wanted to look at, because of these articulating joints can be saddle-shaped, instead of fitting our usual parametric surfaces, we looked at paraboloids and, you know, looking at just A and B in this, we can come up with, you know, purely convex to saddle-shaped surfaces, so which have a negative Gaussian curvature. And he was able to take, for example, the value of A and B and use that as part of his classification scheme for determining the, you know, where these fossils came out right. And interestingly enough, we also have Lucy, sort of the first human family at ASU, and we were right in characterizing that as one of the early humans. This was a project we worked on, again, pottery classification, and also you draw a curve, profile curve, and it would go search the database and bring you back the part or 20 best parts that it could find. This was way back in 99. It's a big KDI grant that I got. We're working with biologists at Harvard and looking at shape analysis of of thalamus, which is a very small structure, but has atrophy because of multiple sclerosis. Now, the atrophy has to happen, and this is hearsay. it's not uniform, and there are certain regions where atrophy because of MS has a bigger effect. So we're trying to come up with some shape characteristics that can show, not only account for different, just because you have a small or a bigger thalamus doesn't mean there is MS or potential for MS because of the different human head sizes. So you have to, accounting for certain characteristics, you want to come up with some shape measures to quantify the atrophy. Okay, the other domain that I've been, so it also gives you an idea of how many different disciplines we've been mucking around in. The typical image vision stuff, and now we're looking at geospatial data, working with, again, a geophysicist. We're looking at monsoon or cumulus cloud accumulation over a mountain, Mount Lemmon in southern Arizona. And then we capture stereo pictures every 10 seconds, and we're trying to recreate the 3D data. Now, the problem with this is that it is amorphous. There are no hard spots, even though from a distance looks like some sort of a solid structure, but it's cloud. To recreate 3D data where you can't, at 16 kilometers away from where this action is happening, you can't really take a survey rod and go 16 kilometers and say, you know, calibrate your system. Some of the road tracking and extraction stuff for geospatial stuff and for registration and change detection. So, and then even in handwriting stuff, so the problem happens is the print optical character recognition systems are fairly good. You know, if you buy a $30 scanner, you get free software with it. But it's good for English, not so good for Arabic and some of those languages. And the basic problem is, if you have any handwriting, it throws off your print OCR. So what you need to do is try to segment out these handwritten strokes that are over printed strokes. And you have very complex topology here. And then also things like, the problem is, as you can imagine, when our forces go into certain areas and discover 5 million documents, and there are not enough human eyeballs with signatures of say, a certain dead president on 250,000 documents. And so how do you know whether whose signature it was, who gave the orders to do what, and so on and so forth. So signature matching is another big problem in terms of shape retrieval. Because people sign, if I give you a 2-inch space, your signature is going to be big. If I give you a 1/2 inch space, you're going to squeeze the same signature. And it is some transform of your mean signature, but still have a shape matching problem. And then it's not always that you take a higher dimensional problem and reduce it to a lower dimension. We went the other way. We take a 2-dimensional handwritten stuff and we actually turn it into a 3-dimensional data. This is actually sort of text turned into tubes, and this is the side view. And we are using this, some underlying math, to resolve the crossover problem. Okay, so sometimes the reason you can see this PowerPoint is because you are embedded in a higher dimensional space. And I always say, if you haven't read Flatland, read it. It's a fascinating book. So now I'll talk about the talk. Say a few minutes about the face biometrics stuff. And then second part of the talk, I want to touch base on the idea of 2D curve matching, and I know it is somewhat basic, but I started looking at problems in terms of very complex surface matching, and I've distilled down to that. If I can't do 2D curve matching, the general problem, I'll save the surface part for my, you know, next 20 years problem. Because there are it's very complex. Even 3D curves, and I'll maybe mention a word or two about that. But let's start with the face authentication recognition problem. As you know, after 9/11, there was a scramble to come up with all these technologies. And just from an academic point of view, even though I would love to be funded just on 3D face recognition, but ultimately it's going to be a hybrid system that does the work. So we have a camera-based scanner that you sit in front and you get a 3D scan. There's a lot of related work. I'm not going to go into that because just like shape matching, I mean, you can touch all the papers that are in this area. Anyway, so our deal or our novelty sort of is to say that two things. When the data comes in, A, we don't know anything about the pose, orientation, whatever. And secondly, somebody doesn't need to mask out just the face part. Those are very critical problems that people assume that you only have just a nice face part extracted, and you're not going to have crap from clothing, neck area, some from hair, and all that stuff. That's one. And secondly, we treat the data as it comes in. A lot of people have worked on Notre Dame data set, which is done with laser, but they smooth the heck out of it. So we take the triangle mesh as it comes out of the scanner. So this is our sort of algorithm steps. We want to classify each point of the mesh based on curvature, and yes, there is noise. You have to deal with it. So most people who work on the Notre Dame data set, they pre-smooth it. We don't. Then the critical thing is that given this data set, and you don't know which side is up, what we do is try to pinpoint the nose point using spin images. And then look at the symmetry plane, and that's now starts getting to be the black art in terms of what critical, biometrically critical points, nose area, face mask, and then we do comparison. So this is quite well known. You can take Gaussian and mean curvature, and the way we do the curvature, we look at this paper me and my student did a couple of years ago. I think it's 2005. It's we apply biquadratic Bezier patches. So for the talk that was late last evening, maybe you want to look at it. And what you see here is combining mean and Gaussian curvature, you can segregate or classify different areas into peaks and pits and saddles and so on and so forth. And we'll look at absolute curvatures here and also Gaussian, mean curvatures. So there is a computational expense there. Maybe you can speed it up with some interesting techniques, but we haven't optimized it. Then we use something called a spin image, which is another old technique. It's a histogram-based technique. So you look at, you take every point, and then you look at within a vicinity of its thing, and you try to create a spin image for that. And we found that it's very interesting that noses have a very peculiar spin image, and it doesn't matter whose nose. We all think our noses are unique, but not so. So obviously only peak points are selected, and this is with clothing and everything. So if there is noise, there is wrinkles in the clothing, there is a potential of throwing it off. So we look at a certain, like a 3-centimeter area radius around every peak point, and we look at the spin image. Now, in the face business, there is two problems, authentication and recognition. Authentication is I walk up to an ATM and I claim to be Anshuman Razdan, and so I only need to be tested against the database of Anshuman Razdan, okay? The recognition thing, which is, I think, an unsolvable problem, is picking out Osama bin Laden at Super Bowl. So that because you in recognition, you can't have a compliant audience that you're looking for, right? Somebody has to step up and say, okay, put me in the database, right? So what we do in authentication is we take the spin image of the subject itself, if he or she is in the database, for comparison. But for recognition, we just use, I don't know how he picked it. He picked somebody's spin image, and we use that for comparison as a model spin image. And so you can see here, you know, we have an open mouth here, but we are able to locate the spin image right on the nose tip. So then, once you know the nose tip here, and again, we don't know the orientation or pose or anything about the subject. All we have done is found the nose. We look at a certain radial area around the nose tip, because we know now that that's going to be part of the face. And we try to come up with a least squares plane. You can't see this red plane, but you can fit a least squares plane through this, and then a plane orthogonal to that roughly gives us a symmetry plane. Now, it's not the real symmetry plane, because if your head is like that, your plane is going to cut right through here. Okay? So that's just a first guess of, is that clock right, and how much time do I have? That's it? Okay. Well, I have to go fast. Anyway, then we have a mirror method that we have used to realign, taking the approximate plane, doing reflection, translation, and alignment to obtain the symmetry plane. I'm going to have to go fast. Then we take a bunch of points for the B-spline curves, do horizontal curves, find some critical points. That's a lot of the detail here. Ultimately, we can extract the nose and a face mask. And the reason we go for this upper face mask, this part, is because it's invariant to expression to the most extent. If you smile, the bottom half of your face changes the most. People also have mustaches and goatees hair, which has problem with data. So we look at this area only. So different poses and orientation, we are able to extract the face mask. Then you have a ton of data, and you need to a ton of features that you need to see how we use Fisher to come up with some initial weights, and I'll skip here. So for normal faces, just on the nose is like 0.2%, and with expression we have a 4% equal error rate. And then you try to do this spice mix of all these features. The problem is that they are not all the same. You can't have one metric, okay? Because some are angles, some are distances, some are all sorts of different things. So anyway, with combination of all these features, comparison, So we have a rank one identification rate for authentication, 100% for faces with normal expression, and about 95.6% with expression. So angry, smiling, you know, you make monkey faces, whatever. So that, of course, creates... we do pretty well compared to the latest paper from MIA that is out there. We do have problems. So in one of my colleagues' classes, these two twins just walk in, God sent. And the only way their parents can recognize them, differentiate them, is because one has green hair and one has dyed them red. So these are the two twins. This is their noses and profiles. Can't tell the difference. So we do have problem. And so with exact twins, or in this case, they were very, very exact. Okay, let me come to the general problem of 2D curve matching. And I'll try to zip through this. So ultimately, the problem is you have two curves, the blue and this maroon one, and you want this answer at the end of the day. So we started looking at first closed curves. Okay, I'll come to the open curves in a second. And you have to come up with a correspondence, and this is important when you are doing image registration. Okay, you have features that you extract from images, and you want to exploit that in doing an image registration problem. So we use a curvature scale space that was developed by Mukhtarian, and the idea is you take any shape and you convolve it with the Gaussian kernel, increasing the kernel in every step. And every step, you're removing inflection points. So ultimately, the curves totally smooths out. So obviously, if you start out with a convex curve, then it doesn't work. But if there are inflection points of zero crossings and curvature, they are right here. And this is your curvature scale space. And then we look at each of these horizontal strings, which is a binary string. We come up with some features that we can map these on a circle, and then we can, if we are doing matching between the two curves, we can do a horizontal shift of this bit pattern just by rotating on a circle. And then, so our contribution in this is that we came up with a dynamic programming method to really make it fast and solvable. So this is used for registration of aerial images. But the problem with this method is that it only works for closed curves. Okay? So, and it works sort of on a global basis. It'll tell you how close one curve is to the other, but it won't do a partial to partial. The thing with closed curves is that you can normalize them because, let's say, by area and closing the curve. So there are issues here that don't work. So here is back to the general problem of open curves. So for two open curves, find the best partial to partial because they only align a certain part, not the rest of the curves. So you want to detect a little piece of one matches with a little piece of another. Now in the infinity case, an infinitesimal small amount of curve 1 will, of course, match every part of curve 2. So the trick is I want to find the longest of those matches, right? Because I can go into a really bad problem. So input curves in this case are open, and it sort of, if you did a brute force approach, it would be an O of N5 problem. Here just the part of this horse matches this man horse figure, just this part. And so what's our method? I haven't published this. This is a paper in works, but I wanted to share with you because of something exciting. So forget the noise in the curve. Somehow you approximate and you have a curvature signature. The trick here is is parameterizing the curves. So there is a similarity transform, which means it has scale, potential scale, which makes the problem really problematic. So how to take the scale out of it? We come up with this idea of integral invariant of absolute sum curvature. And I thought this was a Gauss-Bonnet theorem. I haven't been able to find it, so maybe there is some hope there that there's something interesting that geometers haven't looked at, although it surprises me. So then we do our matching stuff. So you have a traditional curvature versus arc length plot, curve one, curve two, and there is a potential match here. How do you find it? Because there is a scale. Curvature is not scale invariant. So what we came up with the idea of sum curvature. So you start from one point and you start adding cumulative sum curvature, okay? And that's your sum curvature plot. The interesting thing is that if I take a, right, these two semicircles, their sum curvature is pi in both cases, okay? So if I travel from here, and I do, you know, my KDS 0 to pi, and this is 1 over r, and, this is length. So half the circumference, r cancel, and I get pi. So here is a very interesting thing that if you have two curves at different scales, if you start cumulatively accumulating the curvature, then no matter what the scale is, now, don't get too excited. Surfaces are a whole different problem, so I'm saving that for my old age. So here if you see that for the same sum curvature between the two curves, I get different arc lengths. So I've been struggling for it for over a year, and then a new student came in and he said, you know what, how about we plot sum curvature along the x-axis and the arc length on the y-axis, and suddenly something simple like that fell into place. Why absolute? Because it's much more stable than using just sum curvature, because if you have little noise, it can go plus, minus. Sum curvature is much more stable. So then instead of sampling at equal arc length, we sample at equal absolute sum curvature, given curve. And so then you can look at here and say, yeah, I can see there is a correspondence. So I'm talking at a very basic level. Now you can take this and build it into a system of your feature matching scheme and so on and so forth. So we all know that when curve is scaled by k, the curvature is scaled down by 1 over k. So if one curve is scaled version of another, we can use that, our new, we call it, he came up with ASCII, absolute sum curvature that's integral invariant. And I'm not sure if talking about ASCII NIST is such a good idea. It's taken. But so there's a special case where you know that the whole curve is embedded into another one. Yeah, then partial to partial is, partial to whole, we came up with a O n log n, including scale. That's, I think, impressive. The best so far was n square. And then partial to partial, right now we can do it at n cube log n, but I think we can reduce it down to O of n cube, which your general is O of n 5. So some of the results. Some acknowledgments to my postdocs and students and colleagues and some of the named and unnamed sponsors. So I'll take questions.
Okay, any first question?
The curve matching was interesting. My question is related to how do you determine what partial to use?
What do you mean, what partial?
Partial to partial.
Partial, so I skipped through that because of time. Okay. We use a voting method which makes it n cubed. Our hope is that we can use some interesting linear combination or correlation, and then maybe we can reduce it down to n squared. So this is a brute force thing. We know we can do it in n cubed.
Yeah, that's very interesting because that's where the complexity actually lies.
Right.
Right, yeah. I'll follow up with you.
Sure. I mean,
we have a paper which is in print in CNG in the correspondence area, so I'll be very interested in talking to you about your partial matches.
Microphone is gone, so you can't ask any more questions.